Last week, I was honored to participate in a very historic trip to attend the 7th ministerial meeting of the Arctic Council in Nuuk, Greenland. And I attended with Secretary of State Clinton, as well as the Secretary of the Interior, Secretary Salazar. The Arctic Council was founded back in 1995, and it's an intergovernmental association. There's 8 member states within the territory that is contained within the Arctic Circle. The group includes Canada, Denmark, Finland, Iceland, Norway, Sweden, the Russian Federation, and of course the United States. There are also 6 permanent participants representing the indigenous people of the region. The trip was historic for a couple reasons. First, it was the first time that a Secretary of State had led the United States delegation to the Arctic Council. And the fact that not only Secretary Clinton led it as the Secretary of State, but she was joined by a second secretary, the Secretary of Interior, certainly made that historic. It was also the first time that a member of Congress had attended the Arctic Council meeting. We met with foreign ministers of the 8 Arctic Council nations and the representatives of indigenous groups to discuss issues that are related to Arctic governance, to climate change, environmental protection, and watched the ministers sign a historic search and rescue agreement. The Arctic Council also increased its organizational structure. They formed a standing secretariat that will be established in Tromsø, Norway. And they also established criteria for the admission of new observers to the Council. The People's Republic of China, Japan, Republic of Korea, Italy, and the European Union are all seeking observer status to the Arctic Council, which might cause some to wonder, why are all these non-Arctic nations interested in what is going on within the Arctic? And I think that just speaks to the evolving role of the Arctic in geopolitics in the world as we know it today. The search and rescue agreement, the first ever legally binding agreement among Arctic states negotiated under the auspices of the Arctic Council, will strengthen the cooperation on search and rescue between Arctic states. As the Arctic sea ice decreases, maritime activities are clearly on the rise in the Arctic. Aviation traffic is also on the rise as we see new polar aviation routes cross the Arctic airspace in several different directions. But limited rescue resources, challenging weather conditions, and the remoteness of the area render the SAR operations difficult in the Arctic, making it so very, very important that we have this coordination amongst the Arctic nations. Now, under the agreement, on the U.S. side, the Coast Guard will be the lead federal agency for the search and rescue in the Arctic. And while we applaud the role that the Coast Guard plays historically, a very long, distinguished history of operating and conducting rescues in the Arctic, the current status of the Coast Guard's service and aviation fleets makes conducting search and rescue operations in the Arctic very, very challenging. With the scheduled decommissioning of the Polar Sea, the Coast Guard will maintain only one heavy icebreaker in its fleet, and it's not expected to return to service until the year 2013. They're doing some work on that. And while the Coast Guard does have a medium endurance icebreaker, the Healy, the cutter is clearly not equipped to handle the thick multi-year ice that is present within the Arctic. On the aviation side of the Coast Guard operations, the Coast Guard C-130 aircraft stationed in Kodiak, Alaska, are the only aircraft in their inventory that are capable to make the direct flights to the Arctic. So just to kind of give you some sense of the scope, here's the map of the Arctic. The United States is up here, and everything is upside down, so I apologize for that, but that's the way the world is. Kodiak, the island off the southern part of the state here, Barrow here, this is where the air assets are stationed in Kodiak. So to get to any search and rescue operations in the Chukchi, in the Beaufort, off of Barrow or Prudhoe, it's It's over 900 miles. It's the same distance, Mr. President, as the distance between Washington, D.C. and Miami. So if there were an incident in Miami, the helicopters have to fly from Washington to get there to provide for the rescue. And given the often harsh weather conditions in the Arctic, combined with a lack of infrastructure to provide for any forward deployed basing of helicopters, the Coast Guard C-130s can possibly provide the search part of the rescue, but it's very difficult to get to the rescue side. This lack of maritime resources and shore-based infrastructure to protect our aviation resources places the Coast Guard and the United States in a difficult situation in the Arctic. And without concerted efforts and a focused policy for the Arctic, the United States and our Coast Guard are going to continue to be ill-equipped to conduct the search and the rescue operations that are going to become increasingly necessary as amounts of sea ice continue to diminish and the levels of Arctic marine maritime vessel traffic increase. As former Admiral Allen, the former commandant of the Coast Guard, would say, he says, you know, I can't discuss too much about climate change, but I can tell you that there is more sea, more open sea, that I am responsible for in the Arctic. We're clearly seeing that. It's been projected that a seasonal ice-free Arctic Ocean was decades away, and that maritime shipping through the Northwest Passage, through the Northern Sea Route above Russia, and the direct transit across the Arctic Ocean were going to be few and far between. But last year, Russia sent a large ice-breaking bulk tanker through the Northern Sea Route and across the Arctic, carrying hydrocarbons bound for Asia. The Russian Federation has received 15 icebreaker escort requests to provide navigational support through the Northern Sea Route for this year. Compare that to last year, when they only had 3 requests, so you can see the level of commerce stepping up. Transit through the Northern Sea Route, or the Northeast Passage, as it's also called, cuts 5,000 miles and 8 days off of the Suez Route between the Europe and Asia. So you can see why other nations would have an interest in what's going on up there. If they can cut their transit time, it's money and an opportunity for them. Interest in the Arctic by both the general public, the media, in the Arctic and the non-Arctic nations continues to grow for many, many reasons. The Arctic is a vast area. You can see from the map here, it is essentially 1/6 of the Earth's landmass. It has a population within the Arctic area. This red line, if you can see it, is essentially all of the Arctic nations. But the governments that are contained within the some 4 million people who live within this region, over 30 different indigenous peoples, dozens of languages. And while the land is clearly massive in size and relatively barren, it's not like Antarctica, where there are no indigenous people and no governance. The 8 Arctic nations are sovereign governments with laws that govern their land and their people. The Arctic holds clearly vast amounts of energy. We've known this for some time, but until recently, the resources of the Arctic were deemed to just be too difficult to access. They're covered with ice. They're difficult to access. They're expensive to develop. But with increasing access and high energy and mineral prices, the Arctic's wealth, which is estimated to contain approximately 22% of the world's remaining oil and gas reserves, 22% of the world's remaining oil and gas reserves within the Arctic area. Obviously, great interest. It is now being actively explored and developed. 6 of the 8 member nations of the Arctic Council are exploring or developing energy resources in their own waters. And this makes energy exploration perhaps among the more important and perhaps the most serious issues for Arctic policy as we move forward. This includes conventional oil and natural gas, but also the methane hydrates and some of the other less conventional forms. Offshore Alaska, We are expecting or estimating about 15 billion barrels of oil in a concentrated area of the Chukchi. So in this area, and then over in the Beaufort here, about 8 billion barrels. We have suffered serious delays in exploration, but I'm hopeful that we will see exploratory wells prove up this next summer. And while the United States Geologic Survey tells us that the region has the world's largest undiscovered oil and gas deposits, we also think that it holds huge amounts of other minerals like coal and nickel, copper, tungsten, lead, zinc, gold, silver, diamond, manganese, chromium, titanium. The potential there for the mineral resource is equally significant. But there's a natural and sometimes reflective tendency to question how in the world it can ever be safe or even economic to drill and produce in such a harsh, misunderstood, and clearly distant environment. But it is happening, Mr. President. It is happening today, and the technology and the engineering behind some of the existing and proposed activities is advancing rather rapidly. And while we struggle here in the United States to move ahead with offshore development in Alaska waters, our neighbors are rapidly moving forward on Arctic energy development. Russia, which is just 53 miles from Alaska's shoreline, is turning its eye to the Arctic's vast energy reserves as they are building the first offshore oil rig that can withstand temperatures as low as 50 degrees Celsius, and then heavy pack ice around it as well. And as their oil production is in decline, they're also reducing taxes and bureaucratic hurdles in order to encourage new oil development within the Arctic. Norway has been exploring and producing energy in the Arctic, the longest of the Arctic nations. They have found the way, really led the way, for energy development and other activities like fisheries to coexist, and they also lead the world in developing technology to clean up oil in Arctic waters. Energy development, as well as protection of the environment, must go hand in hand. It's as simple as that. I was pleased that the Arctic Council announced the formation of a new task force that will negotiate measures for oil spill preparedness and response throughout the region. The decision to launch these negotiations is evidence of the strong commitment to proactively address emerging issues within the region and to create international protocols to prevent and clean up offshore oil spills in areas of the region that are becoming increasingly accessible to exploration because of a changing climate. Now, Mr. President, one question that I was asked seemingly everywhere that I went when I was in Greenland was, what is the United States' position on the Law of the Sea Treaty? When is the Senate going to move on this? And the U.S. delegation reiterated their support for its ratification of the Convention of the Law of the Sea. I happen to believe that it is crucial that the United States be a party to this treaty rather than an outsider who hopes that our interests are not going to be damaged. Accession to the convention would give current and future administrations both enhanced credibility and leverage in calling upon other nations to meet convention responsibilities. And given the support for the treaty by Arctic nations and the drive to develop natural resources, the treaty will also provide the stability and the certainty that is vital for investment in our maritime commerce. I think it should be pointed out that the United States is the only Arctic nation that is not a party to the Law of the Sea Convention. The treaty was first submitted to the United States for approval back in 1994. It has not been approved yet. Canada and Denmark joined the treaty in 2003 and 2004, respectively. But until the United States accedes to the treaty, it cannot submit its data regarding the extent of its extended continental shelf to the Commission on the Limits of the Continental Shelf established under the treaty. So without a Commission recommendation regarding such data, the legal foundation for ECS limits is much less certain than if the United States were part of the treaty. Now, Russia submitted an extended continental shelf claim back in 2002 that would grant them 460,000 square miles of the Arctic Ocean's bottom resources. You can see the green here is Russia's extended continental shelf, but this lighter green is the area that Russia has submitted to the commission. This is an area the size of the state of Texas, California, and Indiana combined. Now, Denmark and Canada are also anxious to establish their own claims in the Arctic. Norway's claim is currently under review by the Commission on the Limits of the Continental Shelf. Now, according to the U.S. Arctic Research Commission, if the United States were to become a party to the treaty, we could lay claim to an area the size of the state of California. So if you look again, Alaska again up on the top, this area here is area that is within the United States EEZ, this 200-mile area. But this area here, an area again about the size of the state of California, is what our mapping indicates that we would be able to submit a claim to the commission if we were party to the treaty. So this whole area, again, would be area that the United States would be able to claim. If we fail to accede to the treaty and we are sitting on the outside, we have no right to move forward with our claim. If we do not become a party to the treaty, our opportunity to make the claim and have the international community respect it diminishes considerably, as does our ability to challenge the claims of any other nation. Now, some have described the scenario in the Arctic as a race for resources or even an arms race. But I will tell you that after seeing the international cooperation at the Arctic Council, I believe that what we have is an opportunity. This should be a race for cooperation, a race for sustainable management within the Arctic. The Arctic offers a great opportunity to work collaboratively. It is one area where the Obama administration can highlight the international cooperation in the implementation of its U.S. foreign policy. And this, you know, you think about what the administration is poised to do with the reset with Russia. I think the Arctic is a perfect area to do just that. So really, what does the future hold for the Arctic? I believe that the pace of change in the Arctic absolutely demands that greater attention be focused to the Arctic. And I will tell you, it was music to my ears to hear the Secretary of State acknowledge that the United States is an Arctic nation. We are an Arctic nation because of Alaska and its peoples. That was incredibly significant, not only as a United States citizen to hear that, but for the other Arctic nations to hear that statement from our Secretary of State. The implications of the dynamic, changing Arctic for U.S. security, economic, environmental, and political interests really depends on greater attention, greater energy, and greater focus on the Arctic itself. But it will take robust diplomacy and very likely recognition, as Secretary Clinton has reminded us, that the interests in the Arctic is not just limited to the five Arctic nations or the Arctic coastal states or even the eight countries that make up the permanent members of the Arctic Council. It will take a level of cooperation, a level of collaboration to include the non-Arctic states as well. But I am pleased that ever so slowly, the United States seems to be waking up to the fact that we are an Arctic nation and willing to take up the responsibilities as such. I'm confident that with the leadership of the members of Congress, the administration, and from the Arctic community at large, we can continue to highlight the strategic importance of the Arctic for the United States. I believe the Arctic Council meeting may be just the turning point for American leadership in the Arctic.